The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted again to be able to speak to CEO Martin Gulston of Oncommuna, leading life sciences firm offering autoantibody profiling services to biopharma companies to enable precision medicine. So welcome, Martin.
Thanks very much, Paul. I don't think I could have put that better myself.
Well done.
I
guess you've just come back from the States, and big congrats on the recent 7 contract wins and the continued sort of turnaround strategy of the group. But before we sort of dig into the details, I don't suppose you could quickly, in sort of like layman's terms, remind investors top level of what the company does and the sort of the key problems and issues that its technology solves.
Yeah, sure. No problem. So basically, we have the ability to measure autoantibodies in humans, mice, primates, in response to autoimmune disease or diseases that affect the immune system. And then obviously, particularly in drugs in development that are designed to modulate the human immune system. And what we do is the technology base that we use is not used commercially by other people in our field. And we are the key reference lab for that company that manufactures the beads and the bead-based technology. We also have the largest and humanized antigen library commercially available within our sector, which we can apply very flexibly within our system. So we can build bespoke arrays of these human antigens depending on the questions that our customers want to ask. And typically, they're applied in clinical trial settings to stratify patients according to efficacy or look for predictors of serious adverse events, problems that the patients might encounter on a drug that you would need to be able to predict or manage for. And then in discovery, we're finding that increasingly we're being approached to use our technology as an orthogonal screen to add biological validation information to other high throughput screening methodologies like proteomics or whole genome screens.
Right. Okay. So just as an example, if I was, say, I don't know, somebody like Roche, et cetera, and I was developing a new immunotherapy using my immune system to sort of combat sort of cancer, I don't know, some of the lung cancer or pancreatic cancer, et cetera. And I was going through trials and I wanted to basically select patients to be able to best respond to that on the efficacy side and the safety side. How would that profile that you create help me do that better, to get a better selection of patients that would respond better to the treatment?
So typically what would happen is we'd be engaged in the phase two stage of the clinical trial development process. So in old money, clinical development, it starts in phase one.
Yeah.
In cancer, it's always in patients in phase two, and then it moves to phase three, which are the trials before registration for the new drug. And you get larger and larger numbers of patients. And so we would be involved in a phase two trial initially. And what we would do is we would measure the autoantibody response in a patient at baseline before they received the drug, after they received the drug, and then in follow-up. So after they've had the drug in their systems for some time. And what we're looking for is patterns of expression of autoantibodies in relation to the drug, and then matching that to the patient outcome in the trial. And that process gives us a hypothesis and our customers a hypothesis of the key numbers of autoantibodies that are displayed by patients with certain outcomes in the trial. And then by tracking that, you can then apply that in the next larger stage trials, the phase three trials, where you can then use that potentially to stratify your patients.
Yeah, okay.
Or refine the response. And we always start on a discovery basis with large 1500 antigen cassette decks. And then we are narrowing that down through the process to maybe 8 or 10 key autoantibodies, key antigens that we are spotting in those patient cohorts of interest.
Yeah, okay. So that's where the precision medicine comes. It's smart clinical trials. You're enabling smart clinical trials there. Okay.
And precision medicine, indeed. And really what I've seen since I've been here is a growing interest in this technology applied in this way. There's growing interest in big pharma, but also in biopharma, in applying this approach to look at patient response in trials, because it does provide a unique window into the patient's immune system. And what we're seeing as well is the growing increasing importance of measuring immune system response, not just in autoimmune disease and immuno-oncology, but oncolytic viruses and diabetes research, and also in the CNS. So we've recently developed a CNS cassette for neurodegeneration trials as well. So we're looking at the growing importance of this whole space.
Yeah, okay. CNS is what, central nervous system, is it? Is that the
Yes,
Yeah,
yes.
okay.
So it might be neurodegenerative disorders like Alzheimer's,
Yeah,
dementia,
okay. Okay,
that kind
good.
of thing.
Okay. No, I understand that you've just come back from the States from a sort of conference. What's the sort of the demand profile, for the industry for these type of services? Because obviously we've been through a bit of a nuclear winter, unfortunately, for the last 2 years for biopharma, because as interest rates have gone up, their funding line, particularly in small areas, has been hit. And likewise, if you haven't been in GLP-1 drugs for diabetes and for weight loss, then a lot of the big pharma have been cutting costs as well. So what's the sort of hot off the press view of demand going forward?
Yeah, so the conference I was at was in New York. It was the IO 360 conference that focused particularly in immuno-oncology. So we had very good representation there through from large pharma, but also some of the more innovative biopharma as well. And obviously immuno-oncology has long been the darling of the sector. So it has had the luxury of attracting funding. And we're now moving into obviously GL not GLP
mRNA.
the bispecifics,
Okay, yeah.
so and the ADCs, so they are still very, very popular, but we're also looking at different modalities like TIGIT, which is another up and coming area of investigation. What we saw at the conference was a lot of very positive messages about clinical efficacy of these drugs, and I think a real commitment among big pharma towards these research areas and supporting them. So I think what we're seeing is that this area remains buoyant and strong from an R&D investment perspective, and it remains a priority of several big pharma. The other thing that came out from the conference, we had some good presentations from Citi and Morgan Stanley on the overall health of the sector, and they were able to show some graphs illustrating in comparison year to date with last year, a greatly increased health in terms of M&A activity in the sector, in the space, and even public market appetite for investment. So there's a lot of dry powder in private equity. A lot of private equity funds raised or VC funds raised their capital in COVID, have not been able to deploy it as much as they'd like because of the slowdown, and now have quite a bit of dry powder to deploy. So the indicators and the feeling in the US at least is, I would say, relatively optimistic. My direct experience of being in the industry a long time is that we are typically in Europe 6 months behind the US. But I hear here from contacts in the city that again things are loosening up and purse strings are loosening up, but it's as always, Paul, as you know, it's the area you're in. So if you're
Yeah.
in the right areas, I believe we're in the right areas, then I think it's okay. But if you're trying to develop an antifungal, novel antifungal treatment for toenail fungus, then you're probably going to suffer. It's not going to be a nice, fuzzy, warm environment. But certainly the immuno-oncology space is pretty strong.
Yeah, well, I must admit, I've got a problem with my feet, so I might be interested in that antifungal. What, are there any risks?
Apologies to all antifungal companies out there looking at toenail fungus. It's
Yeah.
used as an example.
In terms of that, sort of like, things coming back, obviously you've won seven contracts. Is there any sort of key takeaways from that? Is that sort of like better internal execution, or is that also a reflective of sort of like certain certain areas that you seem to be winning in your sort of sweet spots, etc.? Any sort of key takeaways from investors there?
Yeah, so I think we announced in early October the new kind of commercial strategy of the business and what business areas we were going to focus on commercially. And it's very pleasing to me that the majority of those contracts were won in those new areas. So a lot around things like adverse event prediction in clinical trials in oncology, or with certain types of drug where they have certain types of side effect profiles that are things to be avoided. And also in discovery, high throughput screening in discovery as well. So the contract wins were really in those hotspot areas, as you call them. And we anticipate hopefully to announce some more soon in those sorts of areas as well. So it's proven to be a productive commercial area of exploration for us. Mm. I think the other thing to say about those contracts is that they were a mix. So we have some new customers within those contracts, as well as some existing repeat business with large pharma customers. So again, very pleasing from my perspective to see both of those verticals represented.
Yeah. And did you win any at all with the CROs? Because I know you've talked about the contract research organizations in future sort of targeting them in addition to your sort of like your core biopharma.
Yeah, so at least one of those contracts came from a CRO relationship. So I think that model is coming to the fore. As you will appreciate, with any kind of negotiations with big pharma and big CROs are no different to big pharma, this takes time. So, you know, we only started those discussions sort of late last year. So, you know, give us time to get to the point where we can announce some results of those discussions. But yeah, definitely interest. And I haven't yet met a CRO or a translational medicine CRO that offers the service we offer. So clearly that enables us to become a point of differentiation for them, which I think is very important.
Yeah. And is that effectively a different route to market? Because obviously you've done traditionally direct selling, I guess, and then CROs, I know you're selling the service to a CRO, but offensively they're selling the service to their big pharma. Is that sort of one of the indirect channels you're looking at?
Yeah, it's clearly attractive to leverage their greater commercial reach. Large CROs have, you know, tens of salespeople running around globally on their behalf. So it definitely helps us to broaden our own commercial outreach. We haven't sat still on that though. We have now got a team of five in the commercial team selling. We have two in Europe. We just announced, or we haven't announced, but we announced. We have a new person joined us in Europe as of this week. So we have a team of five. We have three in the States and two in Europe. I'm hoping to add one more person in the US this year, but next year in our kind of financial year terms. Mm. And by that time, I'm pretty sure we will feel core it for us. We will have a sufficient sales coverage. And I was on a sales team call just this week with the broader team. And what's really encouraging is some of those team are still relatively new, sort of 2-3 months in the business. The richness and the diversity and the number of discussions we're having in the market are just exploding. So just having those extra hands and feet out there makes a massive difference. But certainly leveraging the broader commercial reach of the CRO world is important to us as well.
Good. Okay. And then with those sort of seven contract wins and what you can see, so for what you just talked through your revenue visibility, because I did see in the prelims the sort of target for this year, the guidance is 3 million of sales, which I think is up 150% year on year. So something's obviously working. I guess what sort of revenue cover does that give you, the seven contracts and what you've already booked?
So by my reckoning, we've got about a 75% coverage of that 3 million already. And we obviously have a validated pipeline against the rest, which I'm aware of. So one of the things that I instituted when I joined was alongside the professionalization and building out of our commercial offering was a much more rigorous treatment of our pipeline. So we only consider risk-adjusted pipeline once we've submitted a proposal to a customer, for instance. So the pipeline before that doesn't get counted into our numbers or into our planning for our so-called weighted backlog. And so what that means is that the weighted backlog I'm aware of, together with the fact that we are relatively conservative in how we score that, gives me confidence that the extra 25% is there. So we wouldn't be going out with a number like that without having the ability to reasonably place our hands on it, as it were.
And how large typically is a contract? I mean, obviously it can be any sort of size, big or small, but just a sort of typically, is it 200, 300,000 quid a contract, that kind of stuff?
So I've done a bit of thinking about this. So average contract size most recently has been about 130 to 150K. But within that, we've got a large number of, I would call them exploratory contracts, where they're pilots or they're technology provers, which then lead to much larger contracts. So average contract size going forwards is looking more towards the 200, 300K mark. So
Good.
we're obviously anticipating signing some larger agreements.
Good. Okay, well, look forward to hearing about that later on, in terms of, in the future. What about the sort of cost base? Because obviously you've been doing a lot of heavy lifting. You've been there now with Martin, the CFO Martin Hudson, for the last sort of 6 months, and you've been looking at the cost platform as well, obviously putting in new sort of commercial resource. How do you see that sort of developing?
So there isn't a huge amount of wiggle room in the cost base of the company. It's pretty much a fixed cost base. We've been as prudent as we can, and we've pruned things where we can, and we've invested where we need to, which obviously means the commercial team, building that out and growing that. We've invested a bit into some marketing because that really was completely lacking. And in Germany, we have added people where we need to in project management, for instance, because we're processing a lot more contracts and agreements than we have before. So we need strong project management to manage those and act as the interface between the customer, the sales teams, and the science. So that's quite a crucial, for me, that's a really crucial role in our business, because those are the ones forming the relationship with the customers and looking for new opportunities within what we've won. So again, it gives us another string to our commercial bow if we can leverage that pre-existing relationship to add more contracts without having to go out on the basis of cold calling or setting up meetings or starting afresh with customers.
Okay, good. And so with that particular sort of cost base you're thinking of, you and Martin, and obviously the sort of, what sort of like break even revenue, say on an EBITDA basis, just very, very broadly. I mean, you may obviously make good, attractive gross margins and probably even higher EBITDA margins on a, on an incremental basis, on a marginal basis. But just to give people an indication of what would be a sort of like a, the sort of the level for an EBITDA break even type of position.
Yeah, I think from the numbers as reported, you could probably work it out on the back of a fag packet if you wanted to, but it's around the 5.5 million mark.
Oh, right. Okay. So that's that if you and the commercial team really get this sort of your skates on, then we could be seeing, hopefully, that in a, we'll wait and see anyway, but I won't put money, words in your mouth. Okay. Any is there any other sort of opportunities in terms of, I don't know, data mining or anything like that, in terms of what you've got with your sort of like, your unique sort of like data bio database there?
It's not something we've given a lot of thought to, if I'm honest with you. My perspective is that probably not immediately, and that we're better off sticking to our knitting and concentrating on what we are, which is winning new contracts, forging new customer relationships with the platform. I don't know if there's sufficient value in just purely marketing the antigens or the antigen library. We do have, interestingly, data against several thousand profiles that we've run. And that could be interesting in the future. That could be something that could be mined and could be commercialized. But we've really, the last 7 months have been
Yeah, I know. You've had other
busy.
priorities. Yeah, okay. Okay, good. And just then finally, in terms of future news, when are the interims sort of coming out? I guess probably what, next 3 to 4 months or so? Because I think you're just coming up to, is it February, is the interim period, isn't it? It's the close, I think. Yeah.
So I was just chatting to Martin about this just the other day, actually. I think late April, early May, we'll probably be able to come out with an indication of our interims.
Good.
But obviously, we have a good idea already
Yeah, of course.
ourselves. And the beauty of having got through last year and the disposal, so the accounting of that is quite complex, and the business going forwards is much less complex. So beyond our geographical dispersion, where we're in the US or Germany and the UK, the business has become a lot simpler. So that makes things like forecasting and accounting and just the management accounting. I know Martin's put a lot of work into this, a lot smoother and a lot easier. So going forwards, I would hope that we'd be able to report much more promptly on our financial activities.
Brilliant. Okay, well, look forward in hearing the, how the interims are going, and particularly sort of the outlook and any more new contract wins. So keep up the great work there, Martin, and look forward in touching touching base going forward.
Yeah, thanks very much, Paul. A pleasure as always.
Yes.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.